The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Chah. On the show this week...
The evidence is that it is working. It's not working as well as we'd expected, and it may be working in additional ways. But that's part of the joy of science, isn't it? The discovery.
A vaccine for malaria that could save hundreds of millions of lives. Why has it been so difficult to make until now? And...
Absolutely incredible. If you go to Sichuan, which, of course, Sichuan cooking in China is famous for the peppers, and they will firmly insist that no, they've been
this
in China for thousands of years.
How Christopher Columbus mixed up the ecology of the whole world when he made his journeys across the Atlantic Ocean. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Malaria is caused by a parasite transmitted by mosquitoes. The disease infects hundreds of millions of people around the world every year and kills almost a million. Drugs are available to alleviate the disease, but they only work temporarily, and getting regular supplies to the hardest hit areas in places such as Africa can be difficult. A vaccine for life, of course, would be much better, but it's easier said than done. Creating something to successfully tackle the malaria parasite has thwarted scientists until now. This week brought some welcome news. After 25 years of research, an international team of scientists announced that their experimental malaria vaccine, called RTS-S, has passed phase 3 clinical trials with a stunning 50% success rate. Their work was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. It's a huge advance given the difficulties involved. To unravel the work behind it, I'm joined by Colin Sutherland, who's a specialist in parasitology at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Colin, tell us what the malaria burden it is in the world.
Well, the malaria burden is all the people who are living with malaria infection every day of their lives. It is also the people who are ill with those infections and who may be hospitalised. And then on top of that, the very top of the pyramid is the mortality, which is probably less than a million deaths a year, but may have been as high as 2 million deaths a year a decade ago.
How many cases of malaria are there around the world? And they're not focused equally around the world.
It's a very difficult number to tie down. Few would dispute that it's in the hundreds of millions every year. There's a lot of unreported malaria, but there's also a lot of over-reporting of malaria in many countries where it's endemic.
So in the context of all of that, hundreds of millions of cases, around a million people a year die from this disease, largely in Africa, largely children. The idea that there's a vaccine that has an effect is, I mean, how exciting is that?
It is exciting. It is very exciting because 50% of a big number is a big number. This vaccine is not going to prevent every case of malaria amongst the children who may receive it in an African setting or in a high transmission setting in Asia. This vaccine, for example, wouldn't protect a British traveller going for a short holiday to Kenya. But when rolled out in the areas where the burden is high, it will have a significant public health benefit, and that is very exciting.
So can you take us through this particular study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine? What did it show? How many people were protected?
Yeah, well, the study builds on decades of work that's led up to this vaccine reaching what we call phase 3 trials. And the phase 2 studies were very encouraging, but they were in numbers up to about, 1,000 per study. And usually each study was in only one site, sometimes two sites. This study has enrolled 15,000 children under 18 months of age in 7 African countries, east, west, south, in 11 different study sites. So it's on a massive scale. One-third of the children received a non-malaria vaccine, one that would benefit them but not prevent malaria, and the other two-thirds received the malaria vaccine. Half of those will get a booster and half will not get a booster. So there's three groups in the study. At this point, And there's still years to go. At this point, before half of the vaccinated children had got their booster, they were able to look at all the malaria-vaccinated children as one group before they diverge in their treatment. And so that was 6,000 children were available at this point to be evaluated. And amongst those 6,000 children, the 4,000 in the malaria vaccine group had 50% of the number of malaria cases than in the control group.
And so what were the results?
So the result of that is not just you've got fewer people, actually fewer very young children having malaria illness. There was also, in the small numbers that needed hospitalisation, there were far fewer of those amongst the children who got the control vaccine. So children with the malaria vaccine not only were less likely to be sick at all, they were much less likely to end up in hospital. And it's those children that end up in hospital that we see the deaths among.
And some of the numbers I've heard are that it's something like 55 to 60% effective, according to this these studies. How does that compare to other vaccines? Is that a good result?
It's a good result for a pediatric vaccine with a hope for a public health outcome. This is not the kind, as I said earlier, it's not the kind of vaccine that you'd use to protect yourself on a short holiday.
Something like a vaccine you might take for holidays, typhoid or fever or whatever, they're much more effective.
Yes. Oh, yes. No, you're looking at 90% or better efficacy in vaccines of that sort. So it's important to get this vaccine in context. It's also important to realise this is not the end. This is the beginning of the results coming out now. It's very exciting. It's very encouraging. This is looking extremely positive for this vaccine. But there's a lot of questions still to be answered. There are a lot of data, particularly on the youngest children, still to be evaluated. And what's very important is that the safety aspects are watertight before any African government would then start to think we need to find the funding to roll this vaccine out. So there are a lot of steps.
So tell us a bit about how the vaccine works. What is the mechanism?
Ah, well, I think that question's going to keep people like me in business for some years to come. It's difficult to know exactly how a vaccine like this is working. It's a complicated combination of both parts of the parasite, of a parasite protein that should stimulate antibodies, and another part of the same protein that should get the T cells in the recipient excited about the parasites. So there are two possible mechanisms of protection there. It's not entirely clear which of those is dominant and most important. But the weight of the evidence from the studies shows that the vaccine is working. So therefore, either or both of these mechanisms are working for
us. Is it usual not to know how a drug works, but that it just does?
Well, I'm a firm believer in a mix between the empirical and the rational. So the rational part designed this beautiful molecule and thought we'd know how it would work. The evidence is that it is working. It's not working as well as we'd expected, and it may be working in additional ways. But that's part of the joy of science, isn't it, the discovery. So there's lots of work to be done now, working out what happened in those children that were protected, what didn't happen in the children that weren't protected but still received the vaccine.
And then perhaps focusing on the ones that did work and making the vaccine better. I mean, would you go through iterations?
Precisely, precisely. What comes out of the results we heard this week with no doubt whatsoever is that a malaria vaccine is possible. We have vaccination that's very effective and accepted as part of life for some very simple pathogens like a virus or bacteria. The malaria parasite is a much more complicated pathogen. It's much more closely related to humans than it is to viruses or bacteria. It has many, many genes, many, many proteins, a complex life cycle. It goes through the mosquito stages, it goes through liver stages, blood stages. It's a complex organism, and there's been no vaccine against any pathogen with that level of complexity in any field of medicine.
So if it did make it through all the trials and regulations, I mean, how would it be delivered?
Well, the developers of the vaccine have done a lot of work looking at whether it could be delivered with existing childhood vaccines. And the rollout of vaccines for very young children in Africa is actually really quite good. And by linking this into that, it would just become another part of the childhood vaccination program. And that's very encouraging because it's likely that pretty good coverage could be reached in many countries.
I mean, and a vaccine is for life rather than just for a few weeks.
This is very different from developing a new medicine, because a new medicine for malaria cures the infection at the time. A week, a month, a few months later, that child could have another infection and will need more treatment. A vaccine is a very different thing. It's protection for life, that's right.
Now, famously, malaria is one of the neglected diseases that pharmaceutical companies are always being chided for not focusing on. So how did this vaccine get anywhere near to this sort of level of completion?
Yeah, no, it's an important question. It's good to sit back and look at what happened in the last 10 or 12 years that was different from the decades before. And it's not just about the science, it is about the funding and the public will and the bringing together of various public and private organisations to make this a reality. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation deserve credit for this. They've really been behind this vaccine. I think without that investment, it wouldn't have got to this stage. And also GlaxoSmithKline really do deserve credit for that as well.
I mean, are they going to be the people making this vaccine then, or were they the ones doing the R&D?
Well, they're involved in the R&D. They are the ones who are manufacturing it. They probably stuck with this project not because they could see any profit margin at the end of it, but because there were some enlightened individuals in that company who really saw this as almost a duty of care to the developing world. And, you know, possibly a chief executive who thought this is good press for us to make a malaria vaccine.
Now, the vaccine is here. You say there's work to be done in working out how it actually functions and making it even better. Hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to get to this stage. What happens next? Where does it go? Is it something that they're going to start making immediately?
No, I wouldn't think so. Phase three studies of this type are crucial to the licensing decision that's made by authorities. This may go to European licensing authorities rather than North American, but we'll have to wait and see. So at some point during this phase three process, which still has a couple of years to run before we have all the data, the decision will be made to go for the license or not. And at that point, governments in endemic countries can think about using it as a licensed vaccine and will be seeking funding to do so. And that may be another problem. It could be quite expensive to roll this out, and we don't yet know what the cost to an endemic country government would be per vaccinated child.
But what is the potential for something like this in countries where malaria is endemic? The health burden is huge. It kills, as we said, many small children every year. Is the vaccine the way that this stuff is, that this disease is going to be wiped out, or are there simpler ways of doing that? Or simpler, I mean less technologically advanced ways, rather.
Well, the obvious thing that comes to mind is bed nets. And bed nets are a very useful, relatively low-tech approach to providing protection to children.
So this doesn't preclude something like that?
No, not at all. And in fact, in this study, the analysis takes into account that there's very high bed net use in the study sites. So rather than trying to work around it, they actually encourage bed net use. So this vaccine effect is on top of the protective effect of bed nets. And that's the way we need to go. It's adding intervention to intervention.
Thanks to Colin Sutherland there. If you want to read more on the malaria vaccine, just go to our website, guardian.co.uk/science. Let's have a look at some of the other news stories this week with the Guardian science correspondent, Ian Sample. Hello, Ian.
Hi there.
The first story we're going to look at is patenting rules around the use of stem cell technology in Europe. And, you know, regular listeners will know that a while ago there were some scientists in Cambridge and elsewhere wrote to the journal Nature expressing concerns about the fact that there was a ruling going through the court about whether you could patent technologies made from stem cells. And the ruling came out this week. So what did it say?
So what the European Court of Justice ruled was that you cannot within Europe patent inventions that are based on embryonic stem cells. Now, that means not only using cells that are directly produced from embryonic stem cells. So this might be, you know, you can convert embryonic stem cells into other kinds of cells. It's not only those kinds of inventions. It's also inventions like the methodologies you might use to do that kind of thing. And so even if the actual cells themselves are not your invention, if you have used them in your invention, then you can't use them. And you don't even have to have taken these embryonic stem cells from embryos yourself in your own research. If you've used cell lines which are established around the world, which were originally taken from embryos and thereby destroyed the embryo in the process, you cannot patent that either.
Now, let's be clear, you can still do research on all of this stuff. You just can't patent any medicine that comes out of it, for example. Now, I can understand why these stem cell scientists might have been worried. I mean, is this the end of stem cell medicines in Europe?
No, I mean, a lot of the scientists over here have been incredibly vocal about this, and they're very unhappy about it. And I think the issue has been overblown, really. I mean, if you think practically, there are a lot of people out there who say, look, these scientists don't really have it right. It's not a great ruling as stem cell scientists in this country go and the rest of Europe go. It's a negative thing, but it's not the end of the world. I mean, if you think, it doesn't actually penalize European scientists more than anybody else. I mean, nobody can get a patent in Europe. Everybody can get patents everywhere else. It's not just a thing for specifically for European scientists. So if you were developing one of these therapies, you wouldn't only be developing it for the European market anyway. You would be looking to Asia, to America. So the fact that Europe, you don't get protection there, doesn't really matter.
There's another way of looking at this, which is that around genes and gene technology, many high profile scientists have been very vocal in saying you shouldn't be able to patent human genes in any way. I know that John Sulston was talking about this last year when it was the 10th anniversary of the Human Genome Project. There are the companies in America, for example, which have patented the genes that identify a woman's increased risk of breast cancer. And if you want to do the tests for those genes, you have to pay a fee to those companies, which, I mean, from this point of view, sounds kind of barbaric, actually. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, not being able to patent stem cell technology is something similar. It actually does mean that more people get access to things as long as, you know, there's some backing in the first place.
But you need to get this in perspective, which is this is relating only to embryonic stem cells. And the ruling comes on the back of the European court being against what they call the industrial and commercial use of embryos. Now, if you have, if you're using, you know, IPS technology, induced pluripotency stem cell technology, where you essentially take a skin cell from someone, you reprogram it to an embryonic-like state, and then you turn it into, say, a neural cell, a heart cell, that's fine. You can do what you like with that. If you're using adult or fetal stem cells, you can do what you like with those. If you look at how many clinical trials there are going on at the moment on cell-based therapies, there are only two I know of that are involving embryonic stem cells. The rest are using other types of stem cells. So this doesn't close down stem cell research. There is an interesting question over whether this will make problems for people who want to compare other stem cells to embryonic stem cells. But it doesn't close down stem cell research across the board. A minority of it is embryonic.
Okay, well, let's move on from there to something less controversial, global warming. So this is an interesting story that came out this week as well, the Barclay Earth Project. Now, if I say that this involved a massive computer, global warming skeptics, and Nobel Prize winner, it sounds like the start of a Carry-On film or something. What's going on?
So this is a team I wrote about last year out of University of California, Berkeley, and they're led by a physicist who's been there decades called Richard Muller. And this group is, they walked into this situation for interesting reasons. There's a psychology case study here. They thought that there was such a debate over global warming and climate change, particularly in the US, that and they felt that confidence was not high in the three real official keepers of the world's climate data, those being NASA, NOAA over there, and the Met Office, in the Met Office Hadley Center, and University of East Anglia in the UK, and especially things like ClimateGate and such like. And the initial lack of transparency among some of these early groups led to what he felt was a sort of situation whereby what the skeptics said would go unchallenged, and it was hard to actually look at transparent data and analyze it. So what these guys decided to do was to say, okay, what we'll do is go around, find all the data we can, all the surface land temperature data we can, and we'll do our own analysis, and we will come up with some swanky new statistical methods for doing it. We will ram all this stuff together. We won't have any manual manipulation of the data, which happens in the other data sets, and we will address the climate skeptics' points.
And so this is it's worth pointing out here, when they mention climate skeptics, that these are scientists with scientific concerns and maybe who don't have as much belief in the climate change consensus as others, but they still believe it exists. We're not talking about people who can disregard the science and think it's a conspiracy of some sort.
I think the distinction you want to make is that there are some people who undoubtedly are ideologically opposed to whether global warming and certainly human influence on global warming is real. And there are other people who point out that there are flaws in the way we look at our climate record. And they say some of these flaws might be meaningful. And a lot of, you know, some of those comments, some of those criticisms are legitimate. Now, the issue is that it's quite a difficult situation politically for a lot of scientists to raise concerns. People who do raise concerns and say, I think your data are flawed and are genuine. I mean, skeptics is probably an unhelpful label, but do see flaws in the way climate data are presented. They quite often get slapped down in the same sort of dismissive behavior as some of the more ideologically just dead straight opposed to people. So these guys were trying, the Berkeley team was trying to say, we will take on board the valid criticisms. We will look at those and quantify them and tell you whether they matter or not.
And what happened? What did they find?
They got a global warming, a mean average warming of the world, very close to what the other three groups find, which is about 1 degree since the 1950s, I think is right, but they got about a degree. And that 1 degree just refers to the land surface. And so the land heats up more quickly. So when you put in the figures for the ocean, that figure will come down. That sort of mean global average will come down. But they essentially confirm what the other groups have found. And they have made all their data open. They have made all their methods open. But again, they've run into criticism from scientists and from climate skeptics and from everybody involved in this debate, essentially, as beat them up over something or other.
One of the issues around this project is that it was partly funded by people who have sympathies with, let's say, climate science denial. And I suppose the tempting headline there is, you know, climate science deniers' money is used to prove that climate change exists. I mean, is this ever going to stop? Is this project going to help?
It will help and it won't help. I mean, I've seen articles already with genuinely some climate skeptics saying this is helpful, thank you, which is so refreshing in this just miserable, it's not a debate, it's just a terrible kind of battle between people who aren't interested in knowing what's really going on and people who are, you know, scientists who are trying to tell them what they think is going on.
There's also a Nobel Prize winner involved in this research. What were they doing?
Well, one of the Nobel Prize winners for physics this year, it went to three guys. One of them is Saul Perlmutter, who's at UC Berkeley, and he is on this team as well. He got that prize, shared that prize for his work showing that the rate of expansion of the universe was increasing. But he's on board with this as well.
What a clever man. Thanks, Ian. If you want to read more about any of this stuff, go to guardian.co.uk/science.
And now, the Hanford question.
So my name is Stephen Curry. I'm a professor of structural biology at Imperial College. And I have a Hanford question, which is not related at all to the area that I work on, but it's this thing, I guess, that probably everybody eventually asks themselves in life is, why is there not nothing? Why does anything exist? And if I maybe want to sort of narrow it down to give it a more scientific focus, what I would like to know is, why did the Big Bang happen? Or what exactly happened just before the Big Bang? Now, I know that physicists will probably jump on me and say, well, that's a meaningless question because time itself was created in the Big Bang, but I still want to know.
Professor Stephen Curry there wanted to know what there was before time existed. My next guest found himself fixated at a single point in time, 1493. This was a pivotal year in the story of human society and, as it happens, the ecology of our planet. Charles Mann is a journalist and author of 1493, uncovering the new world Columbus created. In the book, Charles chronicles what happened after Christopher Columbus sailed across the Atlantic Ocean and started moving plants from one side to the other. When he came to The Guardian, I began by asking Charles to explain what the world's ecology looked like before 1493.
Well, as we learn in school, about 250 million years ago, there's a single giant continent that scientists call Pangaea, and geological forces broke it up tens of millions of years ago, and forever separating the Eastern Hemisphere and the Western Hemisphere. And the result was that evolution proceeded on completely independent tracks in the Eastern Hemisphere and the Western Hemisphere. And those ecosystems had lived separate lives for tens of millions of years. And the reason that Columbus is important from a biological perspective is that he, in effect, recreates Pangaea. He brings the continents together, and there's this tremendous ecological collision.
Now, your book is based around Christopher Columbus's exchange. You call it the Columbian Exchange. I mean, is this the name of this idea, generally speaking, or have you invented this?
No. I wish I could have. Yeah. It's always been my desire to contribute something to the language.
Well, let's just assume you have for this conversation.
Oh, that's terrible. It was invented by a fellow named Crosby.
No. I was coming to that in your book.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
I know that's in your prologue, in fact. So you're very honest about this. Yeah. The Columbian Exchange.
Why steal from the best?
The Columbian Exchange was what it says. It's Christopher Columbus going across the Atlantic to the Americas in the 1492. Your book is called 1493. What happened a year later?
Well, there's two reasons for calling it that, or three if you count the mere fact that I thought it was sort of catchy, is that Columbus makes his encounter in 1492. In 1493, he comes over the second time with an enormous fleet, 17 vessels. And on that vessel is every imaginable sort of European creature in addition to Europeans themselves. There's horses, there's cattle, there's goats, there's sheep, there's sugarcane, which is actually an Asian plant but we'll call it European for the moment. There's wheat, there's lettuce, there's strawberries, there's every imaginable kind of European crop that they intend to plant over in Hispaniola, which is the island that Haiti and the Dominican Republic are on. And the idea is that they're planning to transform the landscape, to Europeanize the landscape. And that begins this enormous historical process in which these previously separate ecosystems collide when he effectively ferries over a good portion of Europe's plants.
So for Columbus, Hispaniola was just a big farmland. It was just a place to grow some stuff.
It was a place, the idea was that they were going to farm it, turn it into a little piece of Europe, and he would use it as a base to go to China.
Now, you mentioned the stuff that Columbus took over. The, I suppose, other interesting half of this is the stuff that came back.
Right.
So the list of plants that came from the Americas, which you might not think are from the Americas, is remarkable. We're talking about chili peppers, potatoes, tomatoes. Sweet potatoes, corn, these are things which are culturally you don't necessarily identify with Americans, and corn perhaps, but I mean, tomatoes, they're right. Southern Italian, right?
Right.
You can't imagine Italian food without tomatoes. You can't imagine Irish stew without potatoes. But these are all American dishes, American ingredients.
Right, and it took a while to get settled. For example, with the potato, which made an enormous impact not only on Irish history but on European history as a whole, when it was first brought over, Europeans were very suspicious of it. First, they recognized from the shape of the leaves that it was a nightshade. And in deadly nightshade, they knew it was from a family of plants. It was dangerous. And the second thing is that no Europeans had ever cultivated a tuber crop. There was a staple tuber crop like that before. And they knew it was different. They had enough botanical knowledge to know that it wasn't like a carrot, that it was something completely different. And they were frightened of it.
So how did these individual plants actually become as big as they did? I mean, eventually they realized potatoes were something that could become a staple crop. Tomatoes, there are hundreds of varieties.
Well, they were forced to grow them effectively. Governments realized it, and the different governments in Europe conducted campaigns to force the peasants to grow them. Now, if you're a peasant, think about it. You have this tiny plot of land. You're basically on the edge of starvation, and they're trying to convince you to grow something you've never seen before. And the downside is so huge that you're going to resist any of this. So it's not just a question of the peasants being stupid. It's a question of the peasants being in a situation which they couldn't afford to take risks. And so governments throughout Europe essentially twisted peasants' arms either sometimes literally at the, you know, spear point or gun point, sometimes by just forcing massive government programs to grow these plants. And so in the early 18th century, there are concerted campaigns from Ukraine to Ireland to get the peasants to switch from wheat and millet and other crops to potatoes. And the reason for that is that many of the governments had conducted experiments, and they realized that potatoes, compared to wheat and millet, are a much better crop in terms of yield. Wheat and millet, you know, they're on slender stems. They're grasses, essentially. And if they become too productive, if the head of the plant, the good part of the plant that you eat, the grain, becomes too heavy, it lodges, as they say. It falls over and dies. Whereas potatoes can get as big as they want underground. They won't kill the plant in any way. And the result is that you can get four, even five times as much what they call dry food matter from a tuber that you can from a cereal like wheat or millet or barley.
So it was a good way to feed the growing population.
Right. Well, actually, it was a good way to feed Europe. I mean, Europe had never really been able to feed itself. And the great historian Fernand Braudel was probably the first to notice that when the potato comes, famine ends. And he has these lists of these extraordinary lists of famines in France and Belgium and England. And then the potato comes and effectively famine ends in Europe and bread riots end and all the sort of stuff that you see in, you know, old novels by Dumas, you know, where the peasants are rebelling for bread. All that ends with the introduction of the potato.
Now, one of them, your book starts with a story about another very, 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 very popular, very famous South American plant, the tomato. Yeah. And the interesting part being that when you come across this tomato, it's not from South America. It's been grown elsewhere. The variety itself has grown elsewhere. I mean, that's really gone around the world, and the names of these things that are changed to specific places. Can you just take us through that? Because I think it's a really good example of how many of these plants move around the world.
Well, I always grew up not liking tomatoes because, as we say in the U.S., tomatoes. And I now realize it is because they're grown in supermarkets and they're awful. And in the early 90s, I came in contact with what we call heirloom tomatoes, these sort of fancy tomatoes that are the traditional tomato. And I really liked them. I started planting them. And then when you can get these catalogs, they're sort of like tomato pornography, you know, these luscious, you know, pictures of these sort of dripping tomatoes. And if you look at them, they're always from sort of odd parts of the world. And in my area in Massachusetts, in the east coast of the United States, ones that grow particularly well are often from Japan or from Russia or Ukraine. And I was puzzled by this because I sort of had this vague idea that tomatoes were from the Americas. And in fact, they've been ferried over from Mexico, adapted to local conditions in different parts of the world, and then brought back to the Americas. And this is just one small example of the kind of Columbian Exchange thing that we're talking about. What was striking to me is here I'm growing a garden, you know, I'm championing local produce and, you know, producing my own thing. And in fact, what I'm growing is an exotic modern object that's been shaped, you know, by hands across the world.
It's a beautiful example of sort of forced evolution, isn't
right.
it?
Right.
Exactly. What are the original tomatoes like? I mean, are there, do those plants?
They come from the Andes, actually. I was completely surprised. And the last time I was down there, I made a point of, I contacted a botanist and we went and looked at them. And it's inexplicable. There's these little green things. They look sort of like grapes, and somehow they're transported to Mexico. They're not. They're toxic if you eat them. Again, tomatoes are nightshades, and it's part of the same family of plants as potatoes, which is sort of weird to think about. And they were brought to Mexico. Nobody knows why. And somehow people in Mexico bred not only the tomato but the tomatilla out of them. It's really, you know, kind of a remarkable example of the beginning parts of the Columbian Exchange. And then in Mexico, they really only have one or two types of tomatoes. And then they come across to the rest of the world and they're bred for local conditions. And you have the kind of explosion of tomato breeding that results in the production of those pornographic catalogs that I was mentioning.
So from there, do you have a favorite tomato?
I'm afraid to say that I'm the sort of tomato nerd that, in fact, does have a favorite tomato.
And, I hope so.
Right. And there's one that we particularly like. It's called the Green Zebra, which is a striped green tomato that is meant to be green and actually has a sort of a yellowish and green skin. And they're fantastic on salads.
Okay, one more plant before we get onto the heavier science. Chili peppers.
Yes.
Around the world, from Indian cooking to, Szechuan cooking to all sorts of places. Chilies are a de facto ingredient in those places. That's you go to those places, that's what you assume is there. Again, a South American plant.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. If you go to Sichuan, which, of course, Sichuan cooking in China is famous for the peppers, and you can get these dishes that are essentially a mound of chili peppers with a little bit of other stuff in there. And you go to them and you say, this is an American plant, and they will firmly insist that no, they've been
this
in China
how we've
for,
always done
right, for thousands of years. And in fact, there are in various Chinese agricultural journals, there are these sort of bogus nationalist papers where they try to explain that somehow they were in fact Chinese all along, and all these botanists are wrong in the West and who are trying to steal from the Chinese. But in fact, they came in very quickly. I think there's a case where they didn't have to be promulgated, because very quickly people realized that you could put them in food and with preserved meat. Peppers, have a natural antibiotic function, and so it literally is healthier in places without refrigeration to eat peppers, chili peppers, than it is without them. And so in hot places like India, Southeast Asia, Sichuan, they made the same discovery that people in Mexico and Central America did, thousands of years before them.
I think you're forgetting also the pleasure aspect of eating extremely painful chilies,
right?
Which seems to be a spectator sport in many parts of the world.
Right, you can go to Mexico and people will sort of put themselves into a daze, kind of eating these super hot peppers.
Now, how do scientists track all of this stuff? I mean, your book is largely historical, but I mean, you do mention the DNA tracking that's going on now. For example, the fact that that the tomato has many varieties, and that it's a relative, close relative of the potato. These things have been put onto a scientific footing now with the DNA sequencing and all of that. How do people track all of this stuff?
Well, actually, there's multiple lines of evidence. One of the most interesting areas of research in that is going on right now is the tracking of the foods across the Amazon. The Amazon, as you know, is this huge area. It's roughly the size of the continental United States. And so the question is, where did all these Amazonian fruits and berries come from? And it turns out that when people select crops, the useful parts of the crops invariably become bigger at the expense of the less useful parts of the crops. So wild strawberries are much smaller than domestic strawberries, and you can go on and on. And the apples, wild apples, are much smaller than domestic apples and so forth. And so you can construct these kind of gradients. As you go further from the center of origin, the useful parts become larger and larger, and you can see these tracks across from the west to east in Amazonia. And very recently, this has been backed up by DNA analysis. Now, the interesting thing is the DNA analysis is so complex that you need the kind of physiological stuff that I was talking about as an indication to help guide you. And so by combining the studies of the morphology of the fruit, the useful parts of the plant, with DNA analysis, you can really get somewhere, and that they've begun to be able to track this. But there's a lot of historical evidence as well. Everywhere there's cooks and somebody writes this stuff down.
So the history of this is largely told through recipes, I suppose.
Yes, yeah.
As soon as you hear new recipes with fancy new ingredients, you know that it's the edge of some plant appearing all over the world.
Right, and you probably have heard recently here about the sort of molecular gastronomy. Well, essentially, the ancestors of those crazy people, have existed for centuries and have been taking new ingredients and trying to do things, and often poisoning themselves initially, but doing fairly well later on.
Just talking about the Amazon, actually, we maybe think about now the fact that we live in a very globalized world and that we've now discovered all there is to discover in terms of new foods. The Amazon is potentially another source of completely new things to eat and develop and cultivate. I'm sure that we haven't discovered everything in there.
There's 168 cultivated trees that we know of in the Amazon. A researcher named Charles Clement recently cataloged them all. And of them, only 3 or 4 are cultivated outside the Amazon. So that gives you an idea of what there is still there. And there's scores of plants. Clement is, I think, now trying to catalog them as well. So there are huge numbers of things still remaining there. The big one that's now cultivated is the Pará rubber tree, Hevea brasiliensis, which is basically this rubber tree. It's used for natural rubber. You take the latex-like sap out of it, you take the sap-like latex out of it and produce natural rubber. Natural rubber is still used for about 40% of the world's market, and it's grown mainly now in Southeast Asia. It's essentially the plant that's eating Southeast Asia as demand for rubber is growing with the world's population. And this Amazonian tree now covers an area roughly the size of Great Britain in Southeast Asia.
Well, what does the transfer of all these plants, we've talked about the positive things, but are there negative consequences of all of this sudden movement?
Oh, absolutely. There's two kinds of negative consequences. One is, take the potato in Europe. The potato comes to Europe, and as we mentioned, it essentially ends famine in this broad swath of northern Europe from the Ukraine to Ireland. And part of the reason it does so well is this phenomenon called ecological release, which is when you transplant a plant, or actually any creature, outside of its natural environment, if you don't transplant at the same time it's the things that eat it, its natural predators and pests, then it will flourish. A big example now in the U.S. is this Japanese plant called kudzu that in Japan is this sort of low shrub. In the U.S., where it doesn't have whatever it eats it in Japan, has become this explosive pest that, you know, covers whole houses and so forth. And this is an ecological release. Potato did something like that. It just grew enormous in Europe, much larger than it is in the Andes. The problem with ecological release is that the loop usually closes. Somehow the pests and pathogens find a way back to it. And this is what happened with the potato blight. So the entire economy of Ireland becomes dependent on the potato. 40% of the Irish eat nothing but potatoes. It's a huge deal in Ireland, as we know. And then potato pathogen, this water mold, comes to Europe about 100 years later, and just it's an ocean of breakfast as far as the pest is concerned. It just wipes it out, and there's this catastrophe for Ireland. Another type of problem is when you bring in new crops, people generally don't know how to plant them at first. And so in China, they brought in sweet potato and maize, which could grow in high areas, dry areas, so you couldn't grow rice. And it led to an immense expansion of the Chinese food supply. But because they didn't know how to cultivate in those high, dry areas, it was something that the Chinese had never done. They made kind of beginner's mistakes, and it caused a massive amount of erosion, filled up the Yellow River and the Yangtze River, and led to huge floods in the 19th century that killed millions of people. So there's these environmental consequences and these ecological consequences that come and sort of bite you in the end.
I mean, this mixing must be going on still now.
Absolutely.
And in an unconscious way, as much as anything else. I mean, ships move across the Atlantic and Pacific every single day now, not just every few years.
And they're dumping their ballasts wherever they go, and they scoop up water from one part of the world and dump it in another.
I think we call them invasive species now, don't we? Rather than
you guys in England, I was just reading in the paper yesterday about how you're going to be hit with this Chinese wasp, I think it is, that's poised to decimate your honeybees. We've had some problems with our honeybees as well. The irony is, for us, the honeybee is an invasive species. It drove hundreds of native species of bees extinct. And now, of course, all the farming agriculture is dependent on this introduced species, and we're quite fearful of what's happening, all the pests that are going after it. You know, we're talking about closing the loop. These European mites are now eating our bees.
We've talked about plants and just hinted at other things. I mean, it wasn't just plants that moved. Insects, large animals moved too. I mean, did they have as big an impact as the food region?
Oh, in different places, yes. When I was a kid growing up, I got my American history textbook, and the frontispiece of it said the Americas before Columbus, and it showed this mighty Indian warrior, you know, with the feathers on his hat and striding a horse, right? And, of course, the horse didn't exist in the Americas before Columbus. And what happened is that the horse is introduced to mainland America with Cortez when he conquers the Aztec Empire. Indians take, a nanosecond to realize how useful these are, and they start stealing them as quickly as they can and funneling them up north where the Spaniards can't get them, breeding them and funneling them up north. And all throughout the inland west of the United States, people who have been farming suddenly are in the position that, you know, Central European farmers were when Genghis Khan came. It's not good to be a small farmer when mounted horsemen are attacking you because you're stuck near your farm and they can just come and get you. And they de-agriculturalized. They threw down their plows and foot hoes, and they raced to the south. And the result was to create this empire. The most important result was to create the Comanche Empire, which ruled much of the inland west for about 150 years and was supposedly the greatest horseman the world has ever seen. So you had this complete transformation of societies throughout the American West and the creation of this archetype that was sold to me as a child as this sort of timeless past. And in fact, it's, again, an exotic modern artifact, kind of like my garden.
Well, I was going to just finish up with that, actually, which is that after researching and writing this book, do you have a sort of a thing that you've always loved and you've always liked, which you maybe was always kind of very American, but actually came from somewhere else, and is a representation essentially of what you were talking about earlier, say for example with the tomato or the horse or any of these other things, where it would never have happened if it wasn't for this particular moment in time, this exchange?
I think in the United States, growing up in the age that I did, there was this idea of the wilderness, right? And somehow my ancestors, I'm of European descent, came and we wrecked it all. And there is this enormous forest that had existed since time immemorial. We came with our axes and chopped it down. And one of the real shocking parts of researching this book was to realize that if you think about it for a second, this means that the native people of the Americas were like, unlike people anywhere else, they had no impact on their environment, which is, when you put it that way, sounds sort of like a weird thing to say. You know, it's, what are they, potted plants? And in fact, if you talk to archaeologists and anthropologists and ecologists, huge areas of the American forest were cleared for agriculture. For much of it was left fallow to grow secondary regrowth for semi-domesticates, as they call them. And then they burned extensively in the remaining woodlands to encourage new growth, which is the kind of thing that attracts game animals. And so you had this big forest, but it was really open and park-like and studded with these large expanses of cleared land. One of the first aspects of the Columbian Exchange is when Europeans came over, they brought over all these diseases that existed in the Eastern Hemisphere but didn't exist in the Western Hemisphere. And between 1500 and about 1650, about somewhere between 2/3 and 90% of the original inhabitants of the Americas died. And it was this horrifying demographic catastrophe. Well, one of the impacts was that these cleared areas started to fill in. And this timeless forest that, I grew up on thinking was part of the American past and had been had been pristine and so forth, was effectively created by these European pathogens. And the result is that everything that we're trying to preserve in the Wilderness Act and all these, special parks to set aside to protect nature as it was, we're trying to protect something that was in fact created by Europeans.
It's a very interesting moment to finish on. Charles Mann, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks to Charles Mann there. His handsome hardback book called 1493 is published by Granta and available in all good bookshops on and offline. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.